Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 24th of July, 2017. It's now 6 minutes past one. Many apologies, a slight technical problem there, but we're now fully live with UK Column News. So welcome to today's edition. My name's Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. Where do we start? Events just unfolding very quickly. Russia is always a good place.
Well, Russia Gate, at least. So if we go back a few months, Chuck Grassley, the Iowa senator, had this to say. I'm writing to inquire. He was writing to Fusion GPS. I'm writing to inquire about Fusion GPS's opposition research efforts regarding President Trump, particularly the dossier compiled for your company by Mr. Christopher Steele. Christopher Steele, of course, the ex-MI6 operative who wrote the dodgy dossier. And the establishment in the United States, Brian, absolutely seemed to be doubling down on this this nonsense rhetoric about Trump and the Russians colluding. Now, Fusion GPS, as we say, was the research outfit which commissioned the report, and Grassley has been saying that he wants to get to the bottom of it. And what's been interesting, Brian, is that if you watch what the mainstream media is saying, they are pushing out a narrative that Fusion GPS was working for the Russians. But they don't say which Russians. And, well, it is related, I believe, to this court case, which was involving money laundering. And apparently the Russian firm concerned and the United States government, who was suing them, each claimed victory over this a couple of months ago. And so then the Russian lawyer who was involved in this case apparently met with Donald Trump Jr. And this, of course, stirred up more nonsense. Now, according to Grassley, because he's holding, Brian, he's holding an open hearing in the Judiciary Committee on Wednesday this week, and he has asked Donald Trump Jr. to attend that, but he also asked the head man at Fusion GPS to attend, and that is Glenn Simpson. And Glenn Simpson, surprise, surprise, has decided to plead the Fifth
Amendment.
So there you go. He is not going to he's not going to talk. He's going to, if he does attend, he has been subpoenaed. If he does attend the thing, he's going to plead the Fifth. So what does that tell us, do you think?
Well, normally that somebody's got something to cover up. If you don't want to come forward into the public arena and say what happened and be truthful about it, if you've got any reason not to do that, you must be hiding something.
So Grassley being presented in the mainstream media as looking for connections between Fusion GPS and Russia, but in fact it looks more likely, looks more like he is looking for connections between Fusion GPS and the FBI, in particular Mr. Comey. So this looks like an interesting hearing on Wednesday, and I think people need to pay attention to it and also pay attention to how the media reports it afterwards.
Yeah. And remembering, of course, that MPs have come forward to say that the Russians were involved in interfering with our election process. No evidence has actually been put on the table whatsoever. So all of those statements and the questions by the BBC, this was happening, that was happening in relation to the Russians, no evidence whatsoever. Well, let's go to military matters. And the Times here, I think one day last week we were poking a stick at the Times for very poor reporting. And I think this is another another article which deserves about 3 out of 10. Royal Navy's HMS Duncan in show of force for Russian spy ship in the Black Sea. It says that HMS Duncan is in the Black Sea where Russia and the West are competing for influence.
Are we?
I've put there, and when was this policy for our aggressive show of force debated in Parliament? But according to the Times, there's now competition for influence in this area. I don't remember it being debated in Parliament. I don't remember reading any policy documents on this. Is this a little private initiative behind closed doors by Michael Fallon and Theresa May and other unknown people? Well, if we get into the story, we can say it is really quite ridiculous. We have a nice little map showing where HMS Duncan is. And the story began 10 miles off the Bulgarian coast, almost within sight of the golden beaches and sun loungers. A Royal Navy destroyer is searching for a submarine. The computer screens in the operations room on board HMS Duncan flash up dozens of targets picked out by the radar. One is marked red for hostile. This is a mixture of what is this? The famous five. This is immature reporting on an unbelievable scale. Are they looking for a submarine? I don't think so. What are they describing? A normal radar search, which is picking up a lot of ships. And one of those ships is marked red for hostile because it's a Russian intelligence gathering ship. This is there is nothing of interest here. This is the Royal Navy in an area of operations very close to the Soviet to Russia. Freudian slip there, maybe. And why are we surprised that the Russians are showing interest to the to HMS Duncan? So there's no real story here except the story the Times doesn't report, which is why have we got a British warship right in the Black Sea? This must be seen as an aggressive act, but that's not being debated. Well, we always like to come to who's written the stories. And in this case, here she is. It's Hannah Lucinda Smith. This is just one of the average style pictures of her, which you can find on the internet. So it's sunglasses, aren't I looking glamorous here with my socialite friends. She appears to be the lady that's been on board HMS Duncan and has written this unbelievably crass story. Now, we're very interested in Hannah because if you have a look at this is just one source. It's a little website that she's got where she posts stuff from a notebook that hasn't actually been published mainstream. She said that she did used to be an investigative journalist. She worked, amongst others, with the BBC, but she then decided she wanted to be a war correspondent. She got herself a flak jacket. And she went off to the Middle East, and the next minute she's reporting from Syria, and then she's moved across to Istanbul. As you do, Mike, how does this work?
Well, if you're a British journalist working for the mainstream media, this is probably how it does work. She probably entered Syria illegally across the Turkish border, and probably that's why she ended up back in Turkey again afterwards.
Well, maybe she was doing her journalism with the very organisations which the BBC and BBC Media Action had trained in the first place, Mike. So it's not as much becoming a war correspondent. You simply hop from one BBC subversive team to the next. But we followed through, and we're going to have to say at this point, credit where it's due, because we found the Spectator reporting that Hannah Lucinda Smith had investigated dangerous tower blocks with the BBC. And this pointed through to an article. We decided to follow this little line of research, and I'm extremely pleased we did, because this is where it led us. So this is the article that this lady has written, and in this case she's done some real investigative journalism as opposed to HMS Duncan style material. The Grenville Tower blaze was a disaster waiting to happen. And she says in 2010, she spent 6 months working with the BBC on an investigation into concerns about fire safety in refurbished high-rise blocks. So this is 7 years ago. Our findings were conclusive. Fire chiefs and safety experts all agreed that the vogue for cladding old concrete blocks with plastic fascia, removing asbestos and replacing steel window frames with ones made of UPVC was cancelled.
I have to say that we did show a little clip from that documentary that they eventually produced back in at the time, within a couple of days of the event, and it did seem for the BBC to be a relatively good piece of work.
Well, this is, I say, credit where it's due, and we're focusing on this lady. Just we'll go on to that second paragraph. She says later, by the turn of the millennium, the post-war tower blocks that were scattered throughout Britain's cities had become run down and ugly. So in 2000, Tony Blair's government launched the Decent Homes programme, a huge scheme to update social housing stock. But they chose the cheap option, not full upgrade, but to make them look pretty. So there's the nice link in which the Spectator and Hannah's given us that, of course, this is cross-party. This is a cross-party issue. This is not just about the Tory party, because we've got Tony Blair in his own regeneration programme causing the problem way back in 2000. So the article led on here, and this has been reported before, but I think we need to focus on it. This is LBC taking the report that Hannah was indicating and saying that the government sat on the Tower-Block fire report for 4 years. But this key piece of information that the previous housing minister, Gavin Barwell, was given that report. He never bothered to meet the Westminster All-Party Fire Safety and Rescue Group. They never discussed the Lakenall House fire report. This is the key one which set the ground. And where is this man now? Well, he just happens to be Theresa May's chief of staff.
So incestuous.
It's very incestuous. And I know that you're going to be talking about where the government's trying to take Grenfell Tower fire investigations. But could it just be that this is so embarrassing for Theresa May and the Tories that they are desperate to actually cover the thing up from start to finish?
Well, last week, Sajid Javid gave an update in the House of Commons on Grenfell Tower, and he mentioned the fact that the recovery process, the recovery is going to be handed over from Gold Command to Kensington and Chelsea
Borough Council.
But he said that would only happen when Kensington and Chelsea Borough Council had demonstrated that they were in a position to deal with that. And once that was done and was handed over to them, there would be oversight of Kensington and Chelsea Borough Council by the Independent Recovery Task Force.
Well, a little bit later, Mike, I'm going to be coming to a Lib Dem councillor who says that Kensington and Chelsea Borough Council is not fit for purpose. But what you're telling me, I think, is the government saying we're going to give control of the investigation back to the very authority that was responsible for the fire in the first place.
Well, yes. Well, of the recovery process.
Recovery.
Yes. So the investigation will be in the hands of the police, but the recovery process itself is currently being handled by Gold Command. That's going to be handed back to... He hasn't put any timescales on this. It's going to be under the supervision, as I say, of the Independent Grenfell Recovery Task Force. But what he said last week, because they've been talking about this recovery task force for a number of weeks now, but he said last week that the final personnel on that recovery task force haven't yet been decided fully. However, the leader of that task force has been decided, and this is him, John Baradel, who is the town clerk and chief executive of the City of London Corporation.
Oh, this is, I'm feeling a lot more reassured now.
So I wonder, could he be perhaps interested in, maybe concerned mostly about the interests of the insurance companies, maybe?
Well, I think there must be, conflict of interest, vested interest here.
And all they said when they released the press release on this a week or two ago, they said that he would be ably supported by a number of colleagues drawn from London councils, the wider local government sector, including the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. So if there's Kensington and Chelsea council personnel on this independent task force, how is it independent?
Well, because it's not independent in any way, shape or form. And I think we're going to be saying in a few minutes' time that it seems to us that there is a desire for a cover-up from start to finish. So yep. No Hillsborough mistakes where there was a bad job done and eventually the truth leaked out, came to the surface, and then the public were able to take that initial inquiry apart. No. What we're going to do this time is make sure that it's watertight all the way through.
So this independent task force, a multi-agency approach, Baradel in the lead, other councillors, including people from RBKC on there, voluntary sector represented? Would that be the British Red Cross, perhaps? The police, health and fire services will all be on this independent task force.
Collaborating.
Yes.
So no separation of powers. We bring them all together in a nice team, so they're going to do everything possible to cover each other's backs.
Yeah.
Well, as many of you might know, a small UK column team travelled up to London to meet members of the Grenfell community on Saturday. And we took part in a meeting in a little community centre, which we're going to show you some photographs of. But once we'd parked our car and started to walk down the road towards the venue, you're immediately struck by the very poignant flowers that have been left, candles, and also notices. So there's pictures of missing people. There's little comments. There's all sorts of written material posted on boards, mainly held to the railings of the various flats as you come closer to the tower. I decided just to photograph a couple of these because really this brought it home for me. Mike and Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire had been up to London the weekend previously, but this was new to me. And these were some of the things that caught my eye. So this was pinned on a board. It said, my son woke me to tell me terrorists were outside. We looked and saw the fire. Horror. Horror must be when your eyes show something you cannot process. Your body wants to reject this information. We saw people spontaneously vomit. The horror got worse when we realised people were still in the tower. RIP. This is deeply emotional stuff, but I thought how remarkable that a young son faced with a fire, his immediate thought was that this was some form of terrorist threat. And is this because of what he was told in school, Mike? There's an undertone here which I really don't like. We saw material like this one, which is about getting people to unite. There's still a lot of confusion and organisation taking place on the ground. The fight for justice for the victims and bereaved families of Grenfell is almost akin to what happened after Hillsborough, whereby many groups popped up and vied with each other to achieve the same ultimate objective. The sooner these voices consolidate their strengths and begin working as one unit, the stronger and more fortified the campaign for justice will be. The corruption and policies that created the Grenfell Tower tragedy extend across the length and breadth of this country and affects all poor and marginalised communities. This campaign should be framed to address the culture of corruption and neglect that caused so many people to lose their lives, but it should be mindful that it's also speaking up for social ills and inequalities that afflict the nation. Now, I thought that was a really excellent statement. And later, when we were in the meeting, it was apparent that this is very, very true, that there's a lot of passion, of course, still running. And we could see that people were all keen to do the right thing, but recognised there was still the need for the community to come together in one voice. Mm. This was another part of that material on the fence. Somebody had posted Grenfell Tower facts, where, of course, it says straight off that the building housed up to 600 people. And this is a figure, Mike, which we have still never seen reported in the media and the press. We never talk about how many people were likely to have been in the tower block when the fire took place. 24 storeys, 67 metres high, 129 flats and 6 flats per storey. And on the top right there, I found it interesting because it's saying that there were 11 leaseholders.
Is that 11 or is it 77?
Possibly. I took it as 11, but what we know is there's multiple leaseholders, and that must complicate the situation with knowing who was taking responsibility for the inside of the building. If I just try and expand this bit a bit, it says the first 4 floors were originally dedicated to public services until its most recent refurbishment in 2015-16. There used to be social services, a nursery and doctors before these spaces became residential, bringing Grenfell up to, well, this one says 127 flats and 227 bedrooms. But what we can see here very clearly is that the cutting out of the social provision in order to get more accommodation, presumably more profit out, I would guess. And if we go on to this one, some of this difficult to read, but it's really showing comments where the residents were raising concerns about gas pipes in the months before the fire. A fire safety expert ordered for them to be covered. Two-thirds of the pipes remained exposed at the time of the fire. So I don't see how the Borough Council, Mike, has got a leg to stand on, because local people were seeing and reporting the problems for themselves. Mm. This must be criminal neglect as a minimum. Mm. So let's come on to the venue. So this is where we met at lunchtime, and the meeting through till 5 o'clock. It's the Maxilla Hall Social Club. This is partly under the main carriageway, the M40.
The A40.
But that's the urban section of it. And very warm welcome we had by local people. Many of them curious as to what was actually taking place. But by the end of the meeting, people, it was a bit like a UK column meeting in Plymouth, people mixing, discussing ideas. And there was some emotion with people hugging and consoling each other about what had happened. Now, I'm going to bring this picture up because this was Alex Thompson and David Scott sitting, waiting for event to happen. And at that stage, we had seen all of this material posted outside. And I'm going to say it did really impact on all of us, and particularly when you see the tower block as it is. It's one thing to see it as photographs, but it's something very different to see it as it really is. Somebody's just asked in our chat box how many people attended. It varied because people came in, stayed, some went, and more came in at the end. I think probably during the day about 50 people came through that meeting. And I'll also say we found it interesting that having helped to organise this RIP meeting at a very late stage, the local authority chose to do something, and also some of the charities that have been helping, they decided to have their own events. That may have been a coincidence. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because we did have some attendance from mainstream media. We had this Sky TV crew. Here they are before the meeting got started. They brought in some...
So that was Sky on the left and the BBC on the right?
Correct, sorry. Where the lady in red is with her back to you, that was Sky, but we also had some BBC presence. Now, this gentleman I was interested in because he was with, I think he was with the Sky team.
That's right.
I was appalled that he turned up at that event with a Death's Head T-shirt on. I just thought, if you were going to wear something which would be as inappropriate as it gets, you'd wear a Death's Head T-shirt. And I think this summed up these people, because although they attended, we haven't seen any reports from them.
No, and they I don't think they were terribly interested in what was going on, actually.
No.
No.
So the lady in red, I did speak to. I asked if they were going to report the causes and not just the symptoms, i.e. what the community had suffered. She gave me a variety of excuses as to why they couldn't do that at the moment, eventually blushed, and I took it that she was feeling under a little bit of pressure. But since this, of course, was a community meeting and not our meeting, it seemed to be wrong to press her further. Mm. But there we are. Mainstream media attended, but they didn't see fit to report. And we also had some press. So we've got journalists here. And this little team, to their credit, stayed the whole way through. They took a lot of photographs. We think this was reporters from the Wall Street Journal. But we haven't seen any reports coming out from those people either. And this is really what the local community have said to us, that all they see is mainstream reports dealing with the government, dealing with the borough council, but the BBC and the other big channels don't want to get in amongst that UK, amongst that community itself. So if we have a little look at how the meeting went, the lady opening here, we started in fact with prayers, and I'm going to say a big thank you to a lady called Emma. Emma was the first person to contact UK Column to talk about the need to help the community to report what had happened. Emma opened the meeting with some prayers, and we had a minute's silence for those who died. And then this was the introduction into the main part of the meeting itself. And I'll just say that we did have some very interesting speakers coming forward. This gentleman was a solicitor who is offering to give the community help in challenging how the terms of reference for the inquiry are being organised at the moment. And he said, and I think he was absolutely right, that it's vital that the community make their voice heard to get their thoughts into the public inquiry terms of reference, so that it's not just simply driven by the government.
This is one of the areas where it's very difficult for the community, because they have only until August the 4th to put that information in to the to that could possibly affect the terms of reference of the inquiry. And on one hand, that doesn't seem like a lot of time, and on the other hand, they need a bit of time because they're because of the grieving they've got to do and dealing with the stress of the thing.
So
it must be difficult for them as well, because they want the inquiry to get started, but on the other hand, there's this pressure on to get stuff done by a certain date. So it's a difficult situation for everyone, isn't it?
It's very difficult. And of course, one of the things is that the whole environment is of confusion. We'll speak about this a little more in a minute. But this man trying to focus the community to say, let's not let the government and the borough council get away with setting the parameters for this inquiry. Let's get the views from local people. There were some very, very motivating local people that spoke. This lady was talking about the need for healing, and many people are offering their own services within healing and counselling, the areas of healing and counselling. And one of the complaints was that even though they've got skills in the community to do this, those skills are largely being ignored by Kensington and Chelsea Borough Council. Just another picture here to give you a little bit of an idea of the room. So it was a very relaxed, informal meeting, but certainly in the latter stages, people getting confidence and standing up to speak and tell what they knew. And this lady in particular, very, very powerful speaker, because she said that she'd lived through three civil wars. Eritrea, I think, was
Eritrea
is where she'd come from originally. And so she was really comparing what was happening in Grenfell with some of the scenes that she'd seen during these times of civil war. And this is one of the things which certainly impacted on the UK Column team, the fact that here we are in UK, in London, in a very rich borough, and there was still an air of confusion. Nobody knew how many people were assessed to have been in the building. Nobody was too convinced by the death toll being reported by the government. Nobody knew where the survivors were, and it was evident that the survivors had been widely dispersed at a number of very different locations, so it's not easy for the remaining community to speak to them. We heard the tragic story of one man who had been housed, one gentleman who'd lost six members of his family in the fire. And he had been rehoused in a flat overlooking the tower block itself. And despite considerable help and support by local people, we were told at the meeting that that man had ultimately committed suicide because he simply couldn't take the grief of those family members. So who, Mike, would put somebody who had suffered that amount of grief in a flat overlooking the tower I just find this astonishing. We heard stories of supplies, clothing in particular, that's been given to Grenfell community. This has gone to the charities, but more than that, it's apparently been dispersed across the country.
170 tonnes of donations from the public. Most of that, some of it, the Red Cross claims, has been given to survivors. Of course, we've no way of verifying that because the survivors are distributed themselves. The rest has been apparently taken, boxed up and taken away for sale. Quite a lot of it has gone to crew. So there are still lots of questions to answer over what's happening with the aid and what's happening with the money.
And I'll just add to that that a few people did come and speak to us in confidence. And one of those individuals was able to show us some photographs that have been taken of vast piles of aid, the clothing in particular, but also other items in warehouses. But all of this stuff, like the survivors, has been spread across UK, so nobody has any idea what's going on. And of course, the other subject was donations. And so local people were again asking questions about what has happened to the money. The government said it's given 5 million, or just over 5 million, has made that 5 million available for local people. £800,000 apparently given out, but the local community saying that's not what we're seeing amongst the survivors that we are in contact with.
Right, so there's that 5 million fund. That is there. There's 20 million of donations is somewhere. And 800,000 has been given out so far.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we look at the response, Brian, we're supposed to be a first world country. Now, they're saying that this event is unprecedented. Well, perhaps it is. But the response is pathetic, isn't it? Because the government hasn't even appointed the people to the independent task force properly yet. We haven't got all the names of all the people. The only name we've got is one individual who's the head of the City of London Corporation. Yep. Who else is going to be part of this? We don't know. We heard of at least one family who is sleeping in, a family of five sleeping in one double room in a hotel. So five people, two parents, three children, having to sleep in one double bed. We've heard of another family in a hotel, that hasn't had toiletries for 5 weeks.
Yep.
So where is the response? They have taken these people, distributed them around hotels and other places, and yet those people are expected to travel to the support centre to pick up what they need. This doesn't seem...
They haven't got the money to travel, they haven't got the wherewithal to travel, but the local authority says, oh, well, we are providing the services, you just need to come to us to collect what you need. But of course the people can't. So there's... For a disaster area, there's no centralised headquarters, there's no focal point where you've got a coordination team sorting all of this out. In fact, the exact opposite seems to have happened, which is instead of getting a proper headquarters in place where information comes in, the facts are known and the situation can be investigated and controlled, you have dispersed everything to create, I'm going to use the expression, organised chaos. Mm. Why would you want to do that? Well, by the time we were travelling home, you say you would want to do this if you want to absolutely cover up what has actually taken place in this terrible, terrible tragedy.
Right, just one final point, Brian, then. If that's the official response, of course, the community response is somewhat different. There are local volunteers helping survivors. There is aid at Acklam Village being ably looked after by various people. Again, local volunteers. There are local volunteers that have hardly slept since the event. People are losing their jobs because they're volunteering to help. And so the local response has been superb, while the council response and the government response has been pathetic.
Indeed. And tomorrow we hope to bring you some little video clips of some of the speakers. I'll just add that I was able to speak for a short period myself, and I talked about what I had seen in regeneration programmes elsewhere in UK. where a very domineering, bullying attitude by the local authority had simply suppressed local views. People were told what they needed to accept, and clearly people in the audience resonated with that. I was talking about matters in Plymouth some 8, 9, 10 years ago, but local people in Grenfell community were saying, yes, this is correct. They were speaking of fraud, corruption, lies, bullying, something very, very nasty going on the surface, but that community still determined to work together. And David Scott also was able to give a short talk, which is really recapping on the excellent research that he's done about matters to do with the cladding, the fire risks, and also those all important fire regulations. So I think if we sum the day up, it came together, a lot of information there, and we could have gone on speaking amongst each other much longer. So hopefully there will be another bite at that particular cherry. Now, I'll just add this lady in, because we've got The Guardian here saying that Grenfell and a Tory-run council, which is not fit for purpose. Well, who's made this statement? It's a Lib Dem councillor, Linda Wade. And I find this really interesting because, of course, we've just heard that the problems with fire safety started with Blair, then moved through to the Conservative government. But, of course, the Conservative government has been a coalition with this lady's own political party. And I was interested to see that when you look into her particular track record, on several occasions over appropriate recent years, she's been on the Housing and Property Security Scrutiny Committee within Kensington and Chelsea. So presumably this lady holds some responsibility herself.
Quite possibly, yes. Okay, quick advertisement then. AV8, Aidan Crane's event, which took place last May, the DVDs are available. They're on sale on the UK Column website. Head over to the UK Column shop and you can get a copy of those if you would like them.
Excellent.
Okay, let's look at veterans issues then. Here's Tobias Elwood, and he was hosting the International Ministerial Conference on Veterans Issues last week. It was a Five Eyes conference, Brian. So he hosted delegations from the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And this was at the Royal Hospital Chelsea. And over the course of the conference, they were what they describe as identifying overlapping themes and mutual challenges, including for some nations, addressing and treating post-traumatic disorder, rates of suicide and homelessness amongst veterans, barriers to mental health care, alternative therapies, and a veteran-centric approach to provisions of services. But as you read down through the press release, you start to get another clue. Delegates agreed to establish a network between the five nations to share and undertake research and emerging data, confirming their continuing commitment to collaborate on strategies that recognise support and care for the defence and veteran communities across the five countries. So what is this about, Brian? Is this about caring for veterans, people that have been stressed by fighting overseas? Or is this about building a data network and data sharing and big data on the effects of stressful conditions for military personnel? Is this really using military personnel as lab rats?
I'm afraid to say that's what I think is going on. I think something very, very sinister. A few years ago, we had young servicemen coming to the UK Column to talk about very strange things happening when they were supposedly receiving treatment for PTSD. Some of them saying that even though they felt well, they were being told that they needed to take psychotropic drugs in order to prevent symptoms occurring in the future. And one young man said he was, I think spooked to see that a group of friends who had suffered very, very light wounds and some injuries from lifting or non-combat events had come back to UK perfectly healthy. But when he saw them a few months later, he described them as off their heads, on drugs which have been prescribed through the system. So I think something very nasty is going on here, Mike. And of course, we've now got the big charities involved. So we've got profit coming in when we talk about looking after veterans who've suffered as a result of combat.
So following on from that, then, the Law Society Gazette, just before the weekend, published this. Ministry of Defence intent on keeping combat claims out of court. And what they're saying is that Tobias Elwood has told Parliament last week that the doctrine of combat immunity was complex and unclear following some exceptionally protracted claims against the Ministry of Defence. And so the government, as a result, wants to remove the choice of the courts for injured personnel and instead direct them to the MOD-backed compensation scheme. Yeah.
What comes into my mind immediately is this is the system that's presently really going on with the NHS. And we've got lawyers telling us that effectively the NHS now making up the law with regard to compensation or claims of negligence against the NHS. What does the NHS do? Stall, delay, keep the problem going through their system. You don't want it going near the courts. Mm. So this seems to mirror that.
So this morning, the BBC was full of the Industrial Strategy Challenge Fund, which Greg Clark announced today, which is the Faraday Challenge. It's going to put £246 million into research, innovation and the scale-up, as he describes it, of battery technology. So, of course, this is all about using renewables for generating energy in this country, because renewables only work when the wind's blowing or when the sun's shining. So how do you store that energy when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining? So that's what this is all about. Or is it? Because later on in the day, they announced this, upgrading our energy system. This is from HM government, upgrading our energy system, smart systems and flexibility plans. And they have launched this new report to bring some renewed vigour into the rollout of smart meters and smart technology for people's homes, Brian, because we can't do without them. We've got to be able to control our utilities from our smartphones. That's the only sensible way to do it. And therefore, we're going to save apparently billions of pounds every year. But these things, of course, connected to the internet via mobile phone technology. So you're sitting with a mobile phone transmitter in your home running 24 hours a day, and eminently hackable as well, which is all quite interesting, because also today the British government has decided that we can now register our interest in HM government's Cyber Schools programme, a fun interactive learning programme that could put you on the path to a career in cybersecurity. So we're going to create a new cyber army. And
this is inducing more fear into children's heads of children, because we're telling them that you've got to be fearful of what's going on over the internet, and you're indoctrinating the children into the government's policy.
Well, absolutely. But £20 million, this is going into this programme to train 6,000 teenagers. It's going to launch in the autumn. It's going to be run through SANS, BT, Future Learn and Cybersecurity Challenge UK. And it comes on top of the £500,000 for the GCHQ accredited cybersecurity masters bursaries, which were also announced. Matt Hancock, who is the digital minister, said, "Our cyber schools programme aims to inspire the talent of tomorrow and give thousands of the brightest young minds the chance to learn cutting edge cybersecurity skills alongside their secondary school studies." So that's great. We're going to make all our homes smart, and we're going to connect them all up to the internet, make sure there's lots of targets out there for cyber crime. And then we're going to train up. So we're building a nice little industry here. Who's going to pay for it, I wonder?
Well, there's no problem with money. We've just heard that 240 odd million available for the battery technology. So there's only a problem with money when it's for social benefit.
So it is interesting that the Russians are basically calling on the United States to get together to, as they describe it, set the tone for global cyber disarmament. So while we're building our little cyber army, the Russians saying, no, this isn't really the way we want to go. We want to be winding this down a little bit. And this is the Putin special envoy who said this morning that Moscow and Washington should overcome differences in relations and set the tone for disarmament. We need to normalize relations with the United States since an unhealthy situation has developed. Both Moscow and Washington are interested in non-interference in internal affairs and setting the tone for cyber disarmament on our planet. So again, it's kind of being wound up as almost an arms race, similar to nuclear weapons, isn't it?
Yeah, which is all we seem to hear now. So HMS Duncan there in the Black Sea, we've got cyber, we've got terrorism. Where did all of this come from? I think we need to start looking at the power of the City of London, where, of course, we've got control of the money, the Bank of International Settlements, and, of course, our own government, which was described on Saturday by several people as a criminal organisation.
But, of course, that's all finance. On the other hand, is economy. And we've been reporting for a long time. We haven't mentioned it in quite some time. The fact that shipping is suffering heavily because economies, basically things are not being produced to the degree that the shipping companies had assumed they would need boats for. And that photograph, Brian, quite amazing, isn't it?
Yes. Well, there's been big problems with the excess shipping for some time.
So these ships all just parked. And basically, this is Reuters saying that European banks struggle to solve the toxic shipping debt problem. And this is all about the fact that the banks lent shipping companies huge amounts of money at a certain point in time. And the shipping companies took that money, built ships, which are now parked up and can't be used. Because the shipping companies don't have the money, because they're not shipping anything at the moment, they can't pay their debts. This is just another nail in the bank's coffin, it seems.
Yeah. And we'll finish there, I think. So a big thank you again to the Grenville community, people who helped set up that meeting. I can say that we learnt a huge amount by being there on the ground and hearing what local people had to say. We have some ideas as perhaps what we can do to help from here on in. But of course, a large part of it is to keep the whole of the Grenfell incident in front of the public, because the government's agenda will be to allow it to slide off into the long grass. Mm. And thank you very much to our visitor that popped in shortly before we went live today. That was a pleasure. And I'd also like to say a big thank you to people who've donated over the last few days or made subscriptions. But we've still got to be pushing this point. We need your financial support to keep UK Column running. And if we are to produce reports like we just have on Grenfell, of course, that involves money in travel. It involves money in setting up. It involves money in accommodation to get real news reporting out to our audience does cost money. We can only do what we do with your financial help. So if you're not a subscriber, please consider taking out a subscription or making the UK Column a donation. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.